Welcome to another edition of Once Upon an Island, Tales from Lopez. We hope that you had a chance to listen last month to Steve Horn and Stanley Greenthal, who really gave us tales from the 70s, when they, as young men, came here to the island. Young men who now, this coming year, will be 60, both of them. Hard to imagine. Today I would like to start with a poem that I came across, which really ties in to their show, because it was written in the 70s, and it was published in a book of photographs by Kenneth Crump, who used to live here on island on Humphrey Head. And the poetry is by Nicholas Ferrantinos. And it's a very beautiful book called The Islands, with black and white photographs of all the islands, but especially from Lopez. Unfortunately, I don't think there are very many copies still around of this book. This particular poem is called Two Questions and Perhaps an Answer. What brings a man to an island to live out his life, to separate himself from the madness out there, to struggle to survive in a place where survival is a daily visitor, a less than welcome friend who whispers doubts about the wisdom of this latter-day pioneering? And what is it that keeps him there when the fishing is bad, or when the deer eat the garden he thought he planned so well, when the weather plays tricks on him and sinks his boat, or even when the others discover his paradise as a dumping ground for their garbage? Perhaps it is the knowledge hidden somewhere in his heart that there is a sense to this life, which he lost under a rock years ago when, as a child, he played forest wise and free, that impels him to drive yet another nail into another board, which forms that which he comes to call home.
Thank you, Ali. That's a wonderful poem. This is Lori Harrison joining Ali Smalders as we come to you for this hour of Once Upon an Island. We're sitting by Ali's fire. It's a few days before New Year's Eve. And today, this poem leads us right into our theme. Today, Ali and I are going to be each other's guests. We wanted to talk about the value of storytelling, the role it holds in our culture and in our lives, and particularly why Ali and I are interested in asking people on Lopez to share their stories with us and then to share those stories with you. It's a wonderful poem, this poem, Two Questions and an Answer. And I particularly like that line, Ali, where the author says, knowledge is hidden somewhere in his heart, that there is a sense to life. To me, that brings the topic of storytelling right into focus. I think people tell stories to make sense of this crazy, exhilarating, fearful experiment that we're all sharing together. Right? I mean, isn't that what storytelling is about? And isn't that the relief it gives us?
And I have to mention here that it was Mary Laporte who felt that it was important to promote storytelling on the island. And she approached Cynthia Dilling and said to her, Cynthia, I want you to do a storytelling class. And Cynthia said, Mary, I just finished a class in Seattle that I took. I'm not ready to lead a class. What are you thinking of? You can do it, said Mary. And with that, in 1989, the storytellers were started.
And Ali, the storytellers were really busy for some period of time. I remember when I was doing the research for the library book, the history of the Lopez Library book, the storytellers were telling at the library, was it weekly in the early 90s?
I'm not quite sure whether it was weekly, but it was definitely a schedule. I could show you all the schedules saved from all those years. It was a very good group, and there are still some of us around who will continue to tell stories.
And did you tell mainly your own stories about Lopez at those times, or more traditional stories?
It was really more geared to telling stories to children at the school and at the library. And so we tried to tell for different age groups, and some of us were very good with the tiny ones, and others did better with school-age children. And this all happened when Helen Anderson was the children's librarian, a long time ago. Mm-hmm.
It's starting to really rain outside, so maybe this recorder is picking up the pitter-patter of the rain on the roof, but between the rain and the fire, it makes a very nice, cozy day for us to be talking about storytelling. I did a little research on what other people talk about as the value of storytelling, and came up with a quote from one of your friends and a mentor of yours, Allie, which is Ursula Le Guin. And she says that the purpose of telling stories is to keep the world in balance and to affirm life. For me, I really agree with her thought about affirming life. A good story to me helps me remember that the life I'm experiencing is shared and universal, and so the things that frighten me or concern me or upset me, how wonderful it is when I hear a story and find out that it's really a shared journey. And I think for lots of us, that's the value of storytelling. Here on the island, storytelling can help us deepen our experiences, especially for those of us that weren't raised here. And that's important for Allie and I as we choose the guests that we'll be bringing to you over the next years. Mary Harris, our very first guest, told us in October this year about living on her family farm in Center Road as a child. And now, when I pass by and see her family home up there in the woods, I remember her stories. Allie, remember she was telling us that in the 1930s there wasn't much getting out or getting around on Lopez, that she might not see other children living down at Richardson but maybe once a year. And I remember you asked her what she did for fun, and remember she just laughed and said, "Fun? Heck, we did chores." Mm-hmm. It was a hard life on Lopez in the 1930s. And I wouldn't have known or had those details but for Mary sharing her own experiences with us.
We hope to bring Mary back with her sister, and they may have some different memories, because I asked her, "Do you two always agree?" And she said, "Oh, yes," and then made a face, which meant the opposite.
Stories can also help us deepen our appreciation for place. And that's already happening for me as I hear these local storytellers explain what things were like on Lopez in years long before I came. When Steve and Stanley were talking to us last month, especially their images about this fleet of salmon boats going out into McKay Harbor. You know, the lights on the water at night and the bay down there packed with boats. And now when I drive down that way, Allie, I see all of that kind of in my mind's eye, and it elaborates my appreciation for this island. I don't have to have lived through it now to have a different sense of belonging here, when I can envision some of the activities that were here before me and built the kind of, you know, contribute to the life we live here now.
And we hope that that will really mean something to all of the people who came very recently and who actually felt that life on Lopez started when they came and then come to the realization through listening to stories that actually it has been here for a very long time.
Yeah. You know, of course, human beings have always felt the great need to pass their own personal stories down to help make sense of their own lives and make sense of things. Stories help us ground ourselves, don't they? Generation to generation. Around the fire from the earliest times, even before written language. Even drawing stories on the walls of caves. In the scope of things, of course, it's rather recent that we've come to write our own stories down. And of course, for me, it's important to remember that whole cultures still don't have that luxury. Two friends of mine here on Lopez who regularly volunteer in Ghana were teaching in a village a few years ago that only had a handful of books. That's for the entire village. And those books, Allie, were so prized that they were kept under lock and key. Mm-hmm. So my two friends who were there teaching English had no text whatsoever and would occasionally bring this book out, and the children treated it like gold. So you can bet that in that village, those stories are passed down at evening time, person to person. Mary Pfeiffer, who wrote The Shelter of Each Other and Reviving Ophelia and Another Country, is a master storyteller. And here's what she has to say about the value of storytelling. Mary says, "Good stories have the power to save us. The best resource against the world's stupidity and meanness and despair is telling the truth with all its ambiguity and complexity. We can all make a difference by sharing our own stories with real people in real times and real places. Quilted together, these stories shelter us all." I love that quote, and it's been really powerful for me in the last 10 years. It kind of guided Greg and my work when we did collected stories for Kindred Spirits. And it brings us to that question of what kinds of stories we tell. Some people say today in the U.S. and in the West in general that we're telling the wrong kinds of stories, and I agree with that. You know, if you want to expand the metaphor to the fact that the stories we tell are often now electronic stories, stories told in the movies, then violence, fear, and aggression, and living in a random violent universe are themes which are really being told today to today's entire group of people in the West, not just children, but teenagers and adults. I think in the course of history, this is the first time this has been done in this way, and it certainly brings stories very different from fairy tales out.
And you're talking about new stories.
Yeah, well, or movie stories. When you go to the movies and you watch a story for entertainment, then, you know, 40 people get blasted with machine guns. Mm-hmm. Such a heavy diet of violent fantasy, certainly, I don't think can be helpful for children. I know it's not helpful for me. So in my life, Allie, it's important to take care of the stories that I choose to listen to and that I choose to tell. Because I realize that for me, story absolutely helps me form my reality and the reality of those who hear. It offers ourselves and our children stories that will in some way, my hope is that positive stories will offer our children and those that listen a positive view of the world we want to see rather than the reverse of that. You remember when Joe McGinnis was here on Lopez?
Yes.
At the library? He was a storyteller who came in, and he's a professional storyteller who says that for him storytelling is about seeking patterns. We as human beings from the beginning of time on this planet have looked to the tides and the moon and the stars and time to steady us, and that stories help us reinforce our own patterns. And when people's stories match their own, then we feel comforted and less lonely. We have a sense of shared experience and more ease in our lives through those kinds of stories. I was reading the other day about StoryCorps. Allie, are you familiar with this group in New York City who have been collecting stories from average people on the street?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I hear reports about that on the radio.
Dave Issay, who's a master storyteller himself, launched StoryCorps in October of 2003. He set up a booth in New York City's Grand Central Station where people could come in, anybody who wanted, could just come in and interview a family friend or a pal or a relative for up to 45 minutes. And they collected these stories and they broadcast them on Friday mornings on NPR's Morning Edition.
Right.
You may have, and then it became such a positive experience for these folks who were sharing their stories and for those that were listening on the radio that they added a second booth at Ground Zero in New York City and three mobile studios that now travel all over the United States where people are collecting these stories. And they've come out with a book called Listening is an Act of Love, and actually they sell it at Starbucks. So, but in my own life, I wouldn't actually call myself a storyteller, but I call myself a story gatherer. I love collecting people's stories and writing them, giving them back in books or newspaper articles, magazine articles, maybe even a movie in the future. And one thing I've learned for sure from writing Kindred Spirits and a few other books is that every single person has an important story to tell. And that we all want to know that our lives matter and that we won't be forgotten. But let's change the pace here for a minute. Allie is a master storyteller herself. As she said, a member of the Lopez Storytellers since 1989 and beyond. Our show, of course, is called Once Upon an Island. Allie's going to share a story with us now that takes place on another island in her homeland. Allie?
Well, this is a story that I would ask my dad to tell actually almost every fall. And I would like you to imagine a map of Europe. And the Netherlands is just a tiny little place. And then above it, you see small islands. And they continue above Germany and then go up, vertically up along Denmark. All of those are the Frisian Islands. And the one of the Frisian Islands is Skilge. It's called in Dutch Terschelling, which is an impossible word for an American to pronounce. So Skilge, the Frisian word, is much easier. My parents lived there from 1911 to 1921, and my sister and brother were born there, which did not sit well with me because I had to be born on the mainland years later. But I'd like you to listen to a story which is called, no, I won't tell you the title. We will hear about that later. The year was 1839. It was winter, or maybe early spring. Wooden sailing ships still crossed the oceans. They relied on lighthouses to guide them when they were close to shore. Ever since 1594, the island of Skilge had a lighthouse on its western point. It was called the Brandaris, and it's the very one that is still there today. The same one, the same stones and everything that has been there since 1594. But even with the lighthouse, the North Sea remained dangerous, and shipwrecks, as many as 12 in a winter, occurred. For some of the people living on Skilge, the Skilgers, farming was actually secondary to what they could get from the beach. They could glean as a beachcomber. And very often, there were shipwrecks that brought heavy spars to the island. And I keep thinking that it might have been ships built in Maine, and then the spars ended up as trusses for a barn or a farmhouse on the island and may very well still be there. Peter Sipkes Cupido was a man who lived on Skilge and who paid close attention to the kind of weather that brought the likelihood of shipwrecks. He was definitely known as a jutter, that is a name for a beachcomber. Beachcombing was frowned upon by the authorities because officially everything that landed on the beach was owned by the crown, as it was called, the government of His Majesty King Willem I. Peter Sipkus did not see it like that at all. Finders keepers, that was his way of looking at it, and all the islanders agreed with him. Peter Sipkus often found plenty of wood he could use, maybe for fencing or for a chicken coop, or he used it for barter. A nice board for a week's supply of sheep cheese, or perhaps a few skeins of yarn for his wife. At times, someone might even be willing to pay him in hard cash. But it did make sense to be a little careful if you didn't want to end up in jail. And that's why Peter Sipkus always checked things out at night. Then the authorities were less likely to be underfoot. Once, when a northwest gale had been blowing for several days, Peter Sipkus set out from his home on the long trek to the beach, across the dunes that faced the North Sea. As he trudged up the dunes, he pulled his woolen cap farther down over his ears, thrust his hands in his pockets, and narrowed his eyes to protect them from the fine sand that wind blew into his face. He leaned into the wind as he made his way down the dune. The wide expanse of sandy beach lay before him. Even in the half light, he knew right away that he had made a mistake. He should have brought the horse and wagon, the hoss, as they say on Skilge. "A good night," he muttered. "A good beachcombing night," he meant. It was obvious there had been a shipwreck. Lots of wood had come ashore. He would have to come back the following night. Still, he might be able to carry something back right now. He spotted a large barrel, a wine barrel. He moved it with his foot. Liquid sloshed inside. "Better take this home right off," he chuckled. Rolling the barrel along the beach was easy. The sand was packed hard. It had been raining for days. He chose a trail back, which he usually took with the horse and wagon. It had a gradual ascent. On top of the first dune, he stopped for a moment. Should he leave the barrel right here, along the trail, and fetch the horse and wagon? Nah, it was too late for that. By the time he would come back, it would be daylight, and by that time, someone else might be enjoying his wine. No, he gritted his teeth and started rolling the barrel down the dune and up the next one. There were many dunes to cross, and the loose sand made the going cumbersome. He was getting tired. "One more dune," he told himself, and then he'd take a rest. There was a little dune valley coming up. That was a right place to have a little taste of the wine. He came to that little valley, and he was eager. He carefully pulled out the bung and his mouth at the ready. No wine came out, but water and berries. He sniffed, but there was no odor. Should he taste one? He spit it out again and grimaced, hard and sour. Vexed, Peter Sipke gave the barrel a forceful kick with his boot. It rolled down and came to rest in the lowest part of the boggy valley. Peter Sipkus went after it, and emptied the barrel so he could take it home. One could always use a barrel, but still he considered the night wasted. The cranberries, because that was what they were, had come from an American ship wrecked on its way to Sweden. Cranberries were one of the first fruits exported by the United States to Europe. They were packed in water in barrels. Many sailing ships carried cranberries on board for food in those days. The berries, which kept really well, could be cooked as a sauce and were known to prevent scurvy, a disease which gave sailors swollen and bleeding gums. They learned this over time. No one knew yet that scurvy happened due to a diet lacking in ascorbic acid or vitamin C. The cranberries had landed in an environment in which they flourished. By 1880, there were so many that the Crown leased the cranberry bogs to a businessman who harvested the berries and sold them on the mainland. The islanders were allowed to glean what was left after the harvest. And so it happened that my parents were introduced to cranberries on Skilge. Mm-hmm. Once they moved back to the mainland, they ordered a small crate of berries every fall. And when I was a child, I always recognized the little crate when it appeared in our kitchen. And on the island of Skilge, cranberries are still known as Peter Sipke's berries.
Thank you, Ellie. That's such a wonderful story. We want to talk a little bit now about how stories came into our lives, both Ellie and mine, as children. And, you know, Ellie, I don't think I've asked you yet. In your family, was it your dad that told stories to you or your mom?
Well, actually, we did a lot of reading together, but storytelling, the way I consider it, no, we really didn't do that. I heard many little stories from my dad about his life as a youngster, since he grew up in a very unusual place. But actually not until I read the story that he wrote when he was close to 90, my early years, and that kind of combines the little bits and pieces that I had heard over the years. But yeah, I was very lucky to have this kind of written memory of my dad's early years, and I wish that a lot of people would have that, especially if the parent grew up in a different kind of place, which would be hard to understand unless it was explained in stories. And it is always hard to understand the different time. I mean, today, children cannot imagine what life was like for their parents when they went to school. And this is really very true for all of us, because the period of a generation, during that period, things change.
And I think you have written some of your stories down for your children and grandchildren?
Yes, I did some of them. And of course, I have written things not specifically for my children, but I'm sure that they will enjoy reading about that, you know, especially when I'm gone. Mm-hmm. Because that's when stories become important. And I remember so vividly people my age, when I was much younger, I would meet maybe immigrants from the Scandinavian countries, and they would tell me how when they were growing up in the United States, they would ask their parents about stories from their homeland, but they got very little, and they were always told to speak English, because that's what was, everybody was telling you, you have to speak English and don't speak Swedish or Danish or Norwegian. But the folks that I spoke to felt very badly because they were left with all kinds of letters from their grandparents to their parents, and they could not read any of them. Mm-hmm. And I realized that it's so much better to teach your children the language that you grew up with. And I remember when I was a young parent, it was not so easy. You had to be sure of yourself, because I have been stopped a few times on the street when I was talking Dutch to our twins and was told that that was not the way to go, that I was to speak English. I was even told by my pediatrician, and I asked him how many languages he spoke. And I said, I will leave that decision to myself. But, you know, that was the way it was. And I think nowadays people are sometimes upset when they hear a lot of Spanish being spoken. But let's not forget, we all bring a culture that melts into this enormous stew pot of the United States. Mm-hmm. Not really a melting pot, a pot of stew where you can still recognize the parts.
Mm. Yeah. So your dad told his story when he was older. He wrote it all down for you all. Mm-hmm. In my situation, was really quite different. My father, when we were little children, there were four of us in my family, and my dad told us his own family stories at bedtime as make-believe stories, Allie.
As if they were make-believe stories.
Yes.
You did not really know that they were his own stories.
We did not know. And he put himself and his own brothers and sisters at the middle of his stories, but he named them. He gave them crazy names. So we didn't know that he was really talking about himself.
Do you remember what he called them?
Yes. The names of the stories are the Scroochy and Scraunchy stories. And Scroochy is the name that he gave himself, and Scraunchy is the name that he gave to his brother. And so at night, we children, we would just beg for these stories, and Dad would come in and sit down on the side of the bed and tell us what came to be known in our family as a Scroochy and Scraunchy. And interestingly enough, these became much more important to us as we got older, and had our own children, than this legacy that we were raised on, which seemed so natural when we were children, really took on a new importance. My dad, he had a real belief in the power of the subconscious mind. And I discussed it with him later when I was in my 20s and thinking about starting a family of my own. And I asked him about these Scroochy and Scraunchy stories that he would tell us as kids. And he said that he wanted us to go to sleep at night. He wanted his little children to go to sleep at night with happy thoughts, with productive thoughts, and all the better if they had a good moral to them. So, and he was quite the little rascal as a little boy himself growing up in Depression times in Wichita, Kansas. So he had a good bit of material to draw on, and each story had an adventure and some play and some drama in it, but each one always ended with a moral, Allie. And he felt that what human beings give their attention to will guide their actions and their lives. And so it was kind of a gift for him to his children that he wanted us to go to sleep with these good values and morals. And maybe during the, you know, sleeping hours, that would somehow inform our character as we were...
Would penetrate.
That was his hope. So would you like to hear a Scroochy and Scraunchy story?
Yes, I would.
So I will tell this as if I'm my father telling the story to his little girl and his little boys. He had two girls and two boys. And this is the story of Scroochy and the tack hammer. Well, Scroochy was just about 4 years old when this story happened. And it was at the late 1920s, so it was depression times. It was very hard times. And Scrooge's family, Scrooge and Scraunchy's family, they had lots of children, and their dad sold insurance, and their mommy, she was a nurse. But those were difficult times, and there was not enough work to go around. And their family was very, very poor. They were happy. They had a lot of happy times in their family and a lot of joy, but what they didn't have was much money. Even did you know that Scroogey didn't have a store-bought item of clothing until he was much older. When he was 4, when this event happened, his mom was still making all the clothing for all the brothers and sisters out of flour sacks. And then she would dye the clothing. And that was all the clothing that Scroogey and his brothers and sisters had until they were much older. So this was Wichita, Kansas, and the family lived on a little house on 1818 Ida Street. There wasn't much to do in those days for a little 4-year-old, but what Scroogey loved to do even back then was think about building things. And so he would go to the hardware store whenever he could. And in those days, you didn't need a parent's hand to hold. You could just walk down the street. And that's what Scroogey would do. He would go to the hardware store and push the door open, hear the bell sound when the door opened. And he was most interested in this whole shelf of hammers. He especially liked that little tack hammer that was just about his size. He would go day after day and look at this tack hammer, and he looked at the price, and he knew darn straight he didn't have any money to buy the tack hammer, and he wasn't about to ask his mommy or his daddy. He knew the family didn't have any money. But boy, did he want that tack hammer. He even found himself dreaming about it. Well, one day, Scroogey was in that hardware store, and he actually picked up that tack hammer, and it just felt so good in his little 4-year-old hands. And you know what? Even though he knew it wasn't the right thing to do, he took that tack hammer and he put it under his jacket. And he walked right out of that hardware store, feeling like now, finally, he could have this wonderful tack hammer he'd been thinking about. Well, that good feeling lasted as he walked down the street under the oak trees and the maple trees, and he was feeling excited, and he could put his hand on that tack hammer and just feel it, and he was excited that it was finally his. But you know what? By the time he got home, he wasn't feeling excited and happy anymore. He was remembering what his mom and dad had taught him, and that was that we don't steal in this family. And all of a sudden, Scroogey had some pretty hard feelings about what he'd done, and he was feeling his conscience was getting to him, and he was feeling real bad. All the joy was gone. But what to do? He knew if he took it back to the store, he'd get in trouble from the owner, and then his dad would give him a whipping when he found out, and he knew he didn't want to tell his mom and dad because then they'd be disappointed in him. So he was really on the thorns of a dilemma. What was Scroogey going to do with this tack hammer? Well, he decided to go throw it in the field behind the house and destroy the evidence. And that's exactly what he did. He took that tack hammer and he took it and he brought back his arm and he threw it as far as the little 4-year-old's arm could throw it, right into the middle of that big old field that was filled with all kinds of weeds and tall grasses. Well, he felt better for a while, but then not so much. He felt that he had still really made a mistake, and what he wanted to do was go get that tack hammer and return it to the hardware store. And you know what? He looked and looked for hours and hours and many days, and Scroogey could never find that little tack hammer. He didn't find the tack hammer, but sure enough, Scroogey found something more important, didn't he? He found out that he never wanted to steal again.
The moral is stick.
I get, even now I choke up hearing the, you know, telling the little Scroogey and Scraunchy story. So, Allie, those were the kinds of stories I was raised on. And Scroogey was a hellion. He burned down the field by playing with matches. And he did all kinds of crazy things. So we had lots of opportunities as a young girl to learn about the family values. Now, my mom, she was different. She did not tell family stories, but she loved to read to us from books. And I remember very well sitting at her side and hearing especially the crinkle of the plastic covering on the library book as she would turn the pages, Allie. She loved to read to us from, oh, Henry James, Smokey the Cowhorse.
Really?
Or Little Britches. She liked London. Jack London was a big favorite of my mom that she loved to read to us. And that was the extent of it, my storytelling history, until both of my parents got closer to death. And in their case, just like your dad, both of my parents spent their last time, their last days and months, sharing their family stories with us that they had not shared earlier on. Mm-hmm. In fact, Dad and I got to go back to Kansas to attend his mother's funeral, and we spent two whole days. Dad was 63 at the time. He died at 67, very young. But we spent two whole days going around with a video camera, and Dad told me all the stories. Here's where Scroogey did this, and here's where Scroogey and Scraunchy did that.
That was beautiful.
It was, and we've got that video, and I love watching it. Dad telling about his we went to his elementary school, and he's swinging on the swing and telling about when a very sweet teacher gave him a penny for penny candy. It was the first penny he'd received. So these are the ways that stories have influenced my life in that way. Sometimes, too, as you have said to me, Allie, storytelling is a way to pass on information that is too difficult to tell in a family. And really, I think all cultures rely on story to transmit those important lessons and the underlying values and truth that can be hard to teach any other way. And it, as we say, stories can help us find meaning when things turn upside down in our own lives. There was one story I can share with you briefly here before we go to your next story, Allie, and that is about my mom. There was one story in her family that was very important and informed all of our lives, but it was one of those stories that you didn't tell around the kitchen table.
Mm-hmm.
I don't really remember Mom the first time she told it to us, and it certainly wasn't a once-upon-a-time type story, but it was the story of her mother and my mother when she was just an itty-bitty little girl. My grandma was raised in Lewiston, Idaho, when she was about 20, was about the year 1900. And my grandma had fallen in love with this young man in her town that she was determined to marry. She had a number of suitors, though, and my grandfather did not believe that this man that my grandmother had fallen in love with was a suitable match for her. So around 1900, at least in my family tradition, which was the Willows family, the parents had a lot of influence on who you would marry. And my grandfather did choose a different man for my grandmother to marry. She didn't get to marry this man that she was in love with, whose name was Charlie. My grandfather instead chose this other man whose name was James Ferris Willows. He was called Buckskin Willows at the time. He was deeply in love with my grandmother, and although she didn't return his affections to that same degree, it was rather a kind of an arranged marriage. And she did agree to marry him at age around 20, and they moved on to Canada, to Alberta, Canada, where Grandpa became a very prominent farmer. They had the largest land holdings of wheat under cultivation of any farmers in Alberta, Canada. So it was a hard and difficult and busy life for my grandma. And the two of them had three children right off the bat. And then there was maybe about a 10-year period where no children came. And then finally, two more children. The last born was my mother, Ruby Willows. And this little story happened when my mom was only about 18 months old. So the story goes, as she told me, that Grandma and Grandpa, her mom and dad at that point, were living a bit separate lives. Grandpa had the big farmhouse up the creek, but he had built a small cabin for my grandmother, and they lived separately on this big land holding they had in Alberta. The three older children lived with Grandpa, and the two young ones, my mother, 18 months old, and her brother Jim, who was about 4 at the time, were living down in the cabin with Grandma. And as the story goes, my grandmother, it was in the dead of winter, and my grandma sent young Jim up to his dad's house, said, bundled him up and sent him up in the winter snow and said, "You go spend the night with Dad." And Uncle Jim did that. And as the night wore on, what my grandmother did, Allie, was take all of her belongings out of her cabin and stack them outside in the deep, deep snow. She got everything out of that cabin except for the piano, which she couldn't move out of that cabin by herself. I'm imagining this story is taking place at 10 or 11 at night, deep snow in the dark winter of an Alberta winter night. The last thing she took out of the cabin was my mother. She wrapped her in all these warm blankets, my little red-headed mother, Ruby, and she put her in a snowdrift to be safe. And then Grandma went back in the house with her container of kerosene, and she poured a line of kerosene from one end of that cabin to the other, and she lit a fire and torched her own cabin, burning it to the ground. My grandfather saw the light of the burning cabin, and he raced down, and he found my grandma out in the snow holding my mother, and he understood what it all meant. She was burning down her cabin for the insurance money so that she could finally go back to her own people. At age 42 and 1924, and live the life that she really, really wanted. And I understand that Grandpa had loved her enough that he just wasn't willing to let her go. And this was her means of finding a way. So she burned her house down, and somehow the insurance company paid, and she took her two youngest children, bought train tickets for the three of them, and went back to Lewiston, Idaho.
And left the older boys with their father.
Yeah. So this is one of those family stories that...
You did not hear until you were grown.
Absolutely. And then it kind of informed, it made sense of things, you know. I'd heard my father say to my mother, "Well, you're stubborn, just like your mother."
Right.
You know, and here was a model of a woman who, at times when it was not popular, you know, followed her own path.
Mm-hmm.
And she had a very... poverty-stricken life from then on, but it was the life she chose.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, I must say that my mother told me something that I had not known as a child growing up until I was maybe in my early 20s. And one time she explained to me that her father had been an alcoholic and had delirium tremens twice, which meant that he had to go to a detox place and so on. And suddenly, a lot of that made sense to me because I knew that I had grown up in a teetotaler's household. My parents had met as teetotalers. The teetotaler movement was very strong in my home province in the early 1900s, because there had been a tremendous amount of drinking and people not giving their wives sufficient money for their children and so on. So there was this social movement of teetotalers. And I realized that my mother, when I was in student government in high school, was always questioning me if there had been a party, was anybody allowed to drink? And of course, in the Netherlands, 16 is drinking age, So I would say, well, the boys who were 16 were having a beer, you know. And my mother was horrified by that and was always pressuring me to do something about it, which, of course, I couldn't, even though I was part of the student government. None of that I had ever understood. Mm-hmm. But then I understood where she came from.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's all very lovely to make sense of these things as time goes by. And it does seem like people, at least in my family, both of my parents wanted to, and you're, as you're saying, your father too, wanted to share as many stories as they could before they left this life.
Right.
Well, Allie, we've got about 11 minutes left, and I know you've got a wonderful story about solstice to share.
Well, this is a story that I shared last Sunday at the library, and I hope it will fit in our time scheme. And I started by saying we have all just lived through unusual weather, let's put it that way. Some of us were homebound, and others had to rearrange travel plans or give them up completely. And important concerts were canceled, and social activities were curtailed, but it was beautiful, and people were skiing and sledding and enjoying it. But to come down to it, it was inconvenient, especially when it lasted 2 weeks. Now, I would like you to imagine if you had lived not today, but in prehistoric times, at a time when solstice and the turning of the sun was a total mystery. What would it have meant to live through this kind of weather? It would have made you anxious. So far, far back in time, when there was nothing known about stars or planets or galaxies, and the sun was considered like a fireball traversing the sky, and no one knew what caused the seasons. And then, when the days grew shorter and shorter, and the sun showed itself less and less, men and women became uneasy. They remembered having lived through this before. And then the sun had come back. But did that mean it was going to happen again? One couldn't be certain. Moreover, the weather had been more than unusually unpredictable. I mean, the wind had blown fiercely around the dwelling, and it lasted for days on end, while it rained and rained, and then the rain turned to snow. Way too early, it seemed. Did that mean that the sun was giving up on the earth and would not return? The sunshine gave warmth and light. Without the sun, there would be no plants, no animals, no humans. Oh, it was not good to let the thought go that way. But it was really difficult to realize what was going to happen. And as the sun, very pale, set at its lowest point in the sky, apprehension grew. It was certain that there were evil spirits roaming the earth. One had to do something to protect oneself, at least a little bit, if at all possible, from the evil spirits and keep the family safe. So there was one way, the magic of fire and water. Dropping hot coals into water and then washing yourself with that water, it at least gave you a chance of protection. Other people felt that the sacrifice of an animal, unless I mean, if you really carried out that sacrifice just so, the ceremony had to be done exactly right, and then maybe then it meant that the spirits could be kept at bay, and maybe it could help the return of the sun. Now, when I was a child, I lived in my home country, the Netherlands, in my home province, Friesland, and I would stay with my grandmother during the last days of the year. And from December 21st to January the 2nd, we could hear the ringing of bells. These bells were being rung by men in another village who rung the bells in the tall wooden bell tower that stood next to the church. And the sound of it carried so far that we could hear it. And when I stood behind the barn overlooking the empty wintry fields, I could clearly hear the bells. Then, as now, the origin of this custom that had persisted for hundreds of years remained a mystery. But most likely, it was a way to protect from evil spirits. That was my story about that time. But let's go back to those very early days, those prehistoric times. What happened when the sun did come back? Ah, there was feasting and fires. Feasting, well, we know what that meant. But fires, they loved bonfires. But this time, it was not a really good time. There were too many torrential rains, and they would douse the bonfires. So they brought into the house a piece of wood, often a log of oak, and put that in the hearth, and that became the Yule log, a custom that persists to this day. And another custom was bringing in greens into the house to celebrate. And of course, that would be evergreens. Now, I should probably skip my story about the evergreens because it carries us too far. The time now, living through solstice, for us is meaningful because we live in the country and we are aware of it, of this time that the poet Merwin calls season from before knowledge, or days when the sun is loved most. And like the people from long ago, we look forward to the days when darkness will give way to light. And like them, we also consider this a time of forgiveness, of neighborliness, and of goodwill. And we too hope that the world will be a better place in the new year to come.
So with that, we will say goodbye. It's been a real pleasure to sit here by the fire and talk about storytelling and weave a few of our own, hasn't it, Allie?
It was.
We hope you will join us in the new year, in 2009, when we'll be broadcasting our show at a new time and a new day. We will be broadcasting the last Monday of the month of January. Actually, it's a new day, but not a new time. The last Monday of the month at 7 p.m. And we will be interviewing quilters from Lopez, women and possibly men, but we're expecting a couple of women who could tell us about what it was like to sit in quilting circles and tell their stories on Lopez in the early days.
Sounds good.
We hope to see you then. Goodbye.
Thank you for listening.